Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Last time around, we looked at the album A Hard Day's Night, the third Beatles album from July 1964. And this is the second part of our deep dive look at this album. And when we left last week, we were right at the end of a busy recording schedule at the end of February 1964, when they are trying to get as many songs in the can as possible before filming begins for the movie on March the 2nd. 1964. So that gives us the date of March the 1st, where they're back in the studio trying to get some songs done. And the last film soundtrack song that's recorded before shooting begins is I'm Happy Just to Dance with You. One for George.
Yeah,
he's got
John
to have
said that. That was written for George to give him a piece of the action, said John in 1980.
Thanks, said George. and it's, you know, that's is it formulaic? Is it a little bit?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a throwback to the, you know, I want to hold your hand, I want to dance with you. You know, a little bit formulaic. I think Paul admits that, and he says anyway, this one was just a straight co-write for George. So they're quite dismissive. Both John and Paul are quite dismissive. I like this song. I think it's a kind of, you know, very upbeat, very kind of joyous and very infectious.
I think it is what it is. I don't think there's any deep layers to be pulled away from it. And, you know, if you're playing the old Beatles psychology game, this kind of split between John and Paul and George, you know, by this point in 1964, you know, that mightn't be very satisfactory to George to say, oh, here's a song for you. I mean, George obviously had his first written song on with the Beatles. So he had, you know, floated a balloon up into the sky of being a songwriter who could contribute a song for the band. But he wasn't contributing anything specifically for A Hard Day's Night.
No, at this stage, he's in the middle of writing that song, You Know What to Do, that kind of gets lost and then turns up on Anthology. But he is giving interviews at this time saying, oh, you know, it might take me 3 months to write another song. It's just kind of slow. So, you know, he very much sort of confessed that Don't Bother Me was just, I thought I would try and write a song, see, you know, how do you write a song? Can I write a song? So he's not producing anything at this stage specifically for the film. So they've got to come up with a song for George.
And he is saying in interviews, oh, I'm a bit lazy at writing, or I'm a bit slow. And, you know, not every songwriter writes in the same way. But it is interesting that the Beatles provoked each other to kind of work better, work faster or harder. That he, you know, John and Paul are writing songs in very narrow timelines, that he didn't, you know, he didn't see that that's where he should be going, or whether he felt John and Paul have this covered, or whether he hadn't figured out that the money was better in songwriting yet, or, you know, I wonder what was driving him or not driving him.
I think it's indicative of just generally the way that he worked. I mean, he was never, you know, we know when it comes to sort of guitar solos, he's very meticulous. He works things out. He doesn't have the natural sort of musical flair that Paul has. You know, the music just kind of pours out of Paul McCartney. Mm-hmm. George is more, it's more craftsmanlike. It's very meticulous. He's happy to spend a long time. And you see that all the way through, you know, right up to not being a point of conflict in the Let It Be sessions. You know, yes. George wants to take his time and craft the thing, and he puts a lot of thought into it. Paul is much more kind of fluid. He's got a greater facility. Yeah. And I suspect it's just that. I mean, the other thing to bear in mind, and this is where I'm going to talk for an hour about George's songwriting, is did George ever write a bad song for the Beatles? Did he ever write a One and One is Two? Did he ever write a Bad to Me? Well, you know, the...
Don't bother me a bit. Yeah, you Know What to Do got binned.
Yeah, but that's his first song.
Yeah, okay, so fair enough.
John and Paul have had, what, 4 or 5 years?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a myth that was being put about at the time that they had 100 songs ready to go. But, you know, they got rid of all of their kind of crappy songs where at the beginning nobody heard them.
Yes.
You know, thinking of linking, all that stuff. George is having to write these in the full glare of the kind of public spotlight, and also in the context of, you know, he's the third songwriter in a band that has Lennon and McCartney in.
That is true. And I mean, if you're saying Don't Bother Me is day one of his songwriting, and, you know, something like I Lost My Little Girl is day one of Paul's songwriting, exactly. You know, to get from Don't Bother Me to, you know, the songs on Revolver.
So I think it's that his output is less, because I think in part he spends more time on it. It doesn't come as easily, and he has to put more effort into it, and possibly because it's intimidating as well. So on the one hand, it's intimidating to be in a band with John Lennon and Paul McCartney, but on the other hand, that's the competition, so that's what's pushing him. He's not going to bring something in unless it's meets the standard. And so that's why I think that, Know What to Do. It doesn't make the cut. It just disappears. He knows it's not good enough.
Yeah.
So it doesn't get presented.
So I'm Happy Just to Dance With You is, George's song. It's the first ever Beatles song recorded on a Sunday. And they eventually get a complete track and do some overdubs on top of that. It appears live a little bit in 1964 as one of George's kind of spotlight songs before he switched to Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby as being the George spotlight. And, you know, it is an interesting shift in that dynamic that, you know, in the Cavern, it was almost one by times one, you know, John Paul George songs, that it's kind of, you know, here's the George moment. And this is George's soundtrack song. And it's the last song, as we said, that's recorded before the movie is made. So there's never any actual reach to give Ringo a song at this point.
No, that doesn't seem to have been on the cards at all. And I suppose, you know, Ringo's spotlight in the film is him sauntering along the canal. That's not going to be soundtracked by an up-tempo.
Yeah, Ringo song.
But
Ringo has a massive contribution to this film, as we're about to hit upon. They start filming A Hard Day's Night the next day. They finish their recording session on March 1st by doing Long Tall Sally and I Call Your Name. And they go off to the Long Tall Sally EP. But on March 2nd, the next day, filming begins. And the filming officially runs from March the 2nd to April the 24th, 1964. Which, you know, is essentially 2 months. And for a band that have broken through as the biggest band in the world, it's a bit of a risk when you think about it for them to essentially disappear for 2 months and go and make a movie, that they're not doing performances, that they're not doing gigs, that, you know, some other kind of Colonel Tom person might have just, you know, got them on some kind of North American slog. But this is what they've signed up to, is to make this movie. But when they start filming on March the 2nd, the movie does not have a title.
No.
And
Beatles
this
film
is
number one.
Yes. Which, you know, would have been a neat enough title, I suppose. But they need to find a title. And so within that space of them filming, there's one song that gets recorded, and it is on April the 14th. And it's the song A Hard Day's Night. So how do we get from Beatles film number one to A Hard Day's Night? There's the old story, isn't there?
Yes. So this is, you know, they finish filming one day and Ringo says, "Boy, it's been a hard day's night," and they go, "Let's write the song right here." And this is this is the kind of standard built into the myth that Ringo comes off with this phrase by accident, just a malapropism that he comes out with. They hear it. Dick Lester says, there's the title of the film, guys. And then there's, you know, they rush off and John writes a song overnight and bang, and that's it. Little bit more to it than that.
Yes, it's codified that, you know, Ringo, you know, says things like Tomorrow Never Knows and It's a Hard Day's Night and everyone just jumps on it. You do wonder what the ratio is of things Ringo said that weren't ignored, that were ignored to that got used. But, you know, obviously it's, it's kind of one of these Beatle legends that, you know, Ringo just said it one day and we were like, that's a good title. But it obviously is a fantastic title. But the phrase, if you're eagle-eyed enough, has existed before the album, the song, and the movie.
Yes, it's in a book. It's in John's In His Own Right book. So I don't think at any point has John said that Ringo didn't say this. Mm-hmm. You know, he seems to, you know, Paul has said this is when it, what happened, and Ringo has said he said it. John has never said he did. So it could be something that Ringo said, but it was picked up much earlier, and it appears in John's book. So that book is published in March of 64. And, you know, probably people are aware of what that book is. It's a sort of satirical, slightly surrealist collection of poems, that some of which go right back to John's school days. But this book includes a poem called Sad Michael, mm-hmm. which contains the line, he'd had a hard day's night that day, for Michael was a cocky watchtower.
The book In His Own Right, which, as you say, comes out in March 64. It's another amazing thing about that timeline, which is there is so much happening. You know, there is conquering America. There is, you know, they're in the top five records in the States at this point, and they're making a film. They're writing a soundtrack to a film, and at some point along the line, somebody has said, "You need to get a book out as well of original writing and put it into the shops." And there's a little bit of a, you know, it's a massive seller in March 64 in His Own Right. And they do a little bit of promo. There's all those kind of very quaint photos of, you know, John holding up the book, and there's some funny stuff of them tearing up the book and all the rest.
George kind of behind him tearing up the book or pretending to. Yeah. And it's a massive seller. So you think about sort of book sales today, but it sold 50,000 copies on the first day in the UK. So on day one, it sold 50,000 copies. So this is maybe what's keeping them in the public eye while they're off filming. But as I say, it's used there. But John does say, you know, it's an off the cuff remark by Ringo. Although he kind of says, you know, it wasn't said to be funny. It was just a kind of mistake or a misspeaking, you know.
Yeah, and the book In His Own Right, I think, also subtly pushes this. You know, it's another of these things that pushes the notion that the Beatles are a band apart, that they are different. You know, we're not getting a book from one of the pacemakers, for instance. You know, this kind of puts them, you know, into this realm of, well, you know, John is kind of this edge of literacy. And I know certain people pulled the thread at the time and say, well, you know, if he's able to write books with this kind of wording and this kind of novelty, why isn't he putting this into his songs? And that does kind of provoke him a little later on. And but it's they're having conversations with Dick Lester, and this title of A Hard Day's Night comes up, and John does seem to write the song to order that evening very quickly.
Yes. I mean, so you must imagine that maybe at the end of a hard day's work where they're filming, maybe Ringo trots out the phrase. You know, this is a phrase that is in common enough currency between the band. You know, Ringo has said it, John's used it, and then there's a joke made of it, and Lester says, oh, that's a good title. So it's undoubtedly the phrase has been used. It comes into to Lester's hearing.
Yeah, and I've obviously assumed it's a phrase that's used more than once. It's not just used once and everyone clicks their fingers and points, that it's just a part of their lingua franca between the bands.
Yes, I think it's, you know, like that language that they have between themselves, or little set phrases and things like that. So yes, John goes home and writes it, and it's a John song. Absolutely, 100%. He comes in the next day. He has the lyrics written on a little matchbook, cover, and they sort of premiere it.
So, you know, we've talked about A Hard Day's Night being sort of very much a John album and trying to pull the thread of, you know, which bits are autobiographical and which bits aren't. And, you know, he's definitely working like a dog at this point in his life. And when he sings about getting home to you, you know, well, where is his home? Julian Lennon turns one at the same month on April the 8th. And, you know, he's married to Cynthia. He's leading a very different kind of life to the other Beatles, isn't he?
Yes, and he's clearly, you know, he's not present. I mean, he's not present in Julian's life in the way that you would imagine you would want to be. Cynthia is responsible here. This is the period at which he's being advised by his accountant, you know, you're making so much money, you've got to buy a house.
Yeah.
And in July of 64, he will buy the house in Kenwood that sort of becomes synonymous with him all the way through to sort of 68.
Yeah, he buys Kenwood for about £20,000 in July 1964 and then spends £40,000 renovating it to his rock star demands. Maybe this is the first episode of MTV Cribs there ever was. You know, it's got 22 rooms, he turns into 17 rooms. He landscapes the grounds, he puts on a swimming pool. Overall, that £60,000 he spent on it is equivalent to about $1.3 million in modern money,
which
is still kind of cheap by rock star mansion standards in the 21st
maybe so,
century.
But it's the idea that you buy something at £420,000 and then you spend £850,000.
Yeah.
You know, you would think there must have been a house that he could just have walked into for £1 million. You know, he's taking on a lot of work here.
Yes.
You know, there are interviews where Cynthia is sort of saying she has left to kind of furnish this house. And you don't get a sense it's not a cozy family home.
Yeah. And, you know, John stays in the house, but after John and Cynthia divorce, it gets sold at the end of 1968. For 40,000, so that's not a great investment.
That's 20,000 loss. Not a great investment.
You know, that's kind of Apple in a nutshell, in a way. And it's sold to Bill Martin, the songwriter, who, along with Phil Coulter, wrote songs like Puppet on a String and Congratulations, which earns them some money off All Things Must Pass. It's all circular. It's all circular.
So it's it's Johnny's Birthday is the song that they rip off. Sorry, that they do an homage.
So on April 14th, in the middle of filming, John has, you know, he's demoing or premiering this song with Paul to Walter Shenson, the producer of the film. And, you know, they need to get a last minute recording session made to get it down. So on April the 16th, 1964, they get into Abbey Road Studio 2 to record the title track for A Hard Day's Night, and they're still about 10 days off the end of filming. And, you know, we kind of, you know, we've such a tight association with that film name and what it means. You know, it's strange to think that they're kind of working in the dark and trying to feel what was right. It turns out to be so right for the movie, that song. You know, I guess it's a bit like making an album. Sometimes they don't know what the title is till they're finished as well.
It sort of presents itself. But and it comes together. You know, they're still tinkering with it in the studio, but it comes together incredibly quickly. So 3 hours from start to finish seems to be the timeline.
And Maureen Cleave is in the studio when this happens, and she has a couple of recollections.
Yes, and again, you know, I have a lot of time for Maureen Cleave, certainly more time for Maureen Cleave than for Dick James. But she tells a story. And again, she puts herself slightly in the center of it. So she says the original line was, "But when I get home to you, I find my tiredness is through and I feel all right." And she said, "No, that's a bit weak." And said he just immediately crossed that line out and said, "I find the things that you do will make me feel all right." So he just immediately changed it. And she describes the fact that the song just seemed to come together like magic out of thin air.
And it seems to have been a bit of a crowded room in Abbey Road that day because, you know, they are trying to deliver. You know, they know how to deliver an opening track off an album, but now they have to deliver an opening track off a movie. And so you have Dick Lester getting involved, and you know they kind of want something dramatic and exciting and cinematic to kick open the album and the movie.
Yeah, so you can hear on the there are bootlegs kicking around, and the first take is on Anthology 1, and you can hear McCartney's bass isn't quite right. George's guitar is appalling. They're kind of working their way towards something. And Jeff Emerick, in his book, says, you know, Dick Lester kept insisting we need something big. We need a big kind of opening punch. Yeah. And that's why they come up with that really iconic opening chord. And then Lester is again saying, oh, and at the end, we need a kind of dreamy fade out. So Dick Lester plays that joke about, you know, he plays a little jazz piano, and you know, how big an instrument is this that you play, you know, but he's purporting to have some input into the musical arrangement of this song. And Emmerich is very clear that he was not welcome in the studio, and the Beatles did not. But despite the fact that he wasn't welcome, they're clearly taking those ideas on board. So they come up with that opening chord.
It's a very fine balance. I mean, the song certainly isn't compromised by the fact that it has that strident opening chord and that very cinematic fadeaway at the end. Now, we could maybe do a spin-off series of podcasts about the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night and how to play it, and we could do all sorts of things. We're not going to get into that.
Put your finger here.
Play along at home. Do kind of like a guitar Bob Ross on it. But there is a couple of things going on there. It seems to be that there is, you know, a bit of George Martin on piano in the background of that chord. Yeah. And that Paul is playing, you know, notes on his bass. So it's a full sound.
It's a composite. Yes, it's a composite. And I think that's what makes it difficult for people to think, what is that chord? Yeah. You know, you can't just pick up an acoustic guitar or an electric guitar and just play the chord and have it sound, you know, it's
a bit like the chord at the end of A Hard Day's Night, which is also at the end of A Day in the Life, which is also a composite chord. It's not just one instrument making that noise. My favorite anecdote about this is one you dug up from Gary Moore, the late great Gary Moore, who was a friend of George Harrison's.
Yes. So they kind of hung out together. He played on one of the Wilburys tracks. He played on George's last concert in 1992. So he tells this story. I'm just going to read this out. He said, George was a great guy and I had some great times with him. I also had some embarrassing moments, like the time he played me the opening chord to A Hard Day's Night. And it wasn't the way I had played it all those years. And I said, is that right? Are you sure that's right, George? And he looked at me and he went, yes, Gary, it's right. I felt like the earth was swallowing me up, but at least he showed me the chord. All my friends didn't know it, but I learned it. So, so it's just this idea that he's selling the guy that played the chord. Are you sure that's right? That can't be right. That's not the way I play it, you know?
He adds an extra bit of information, which is interesting, Gary Moore. All you guitarists at home can try this, where he says, yeah, when he showed me the chord, it made sense because the little arpeggio fade at the end of A Hard Day's Night are the notes of that chord broken down, which I thought was very interesting. I'm not a great guitar player, but it's certainly worth trying to pick that out and see whether it works. So they do a number of takes on this, and it's track 9 that is the keeper track, and they do a couple of overdubs to get it right. And as we said, you know, they work on that dreamy fade out. That dreamy arpeggiated fade out is a tricky thing to get right. So when they played it live,
when they play it live, it's not quite the same. And there's a terrible version on the first BBC. If you remember that, where I think in the notes, the liner notes, they say they had forgotten how to do it. So what they do is they just splice in an edit from the single.
And then pretend that they've been playing it.
And it's the most ham-fisted edit. You know, it's not even close.
So there's overdubbing. There's a potential George solo, but that doesn't happen. Jeff Emerick, he's not particularly kind about George's contribution to Hard Day's Night.
This is why I really despise. I was going to say dislike, but it's more dislike this book. Yeah, he says, George was even more ham-fisted than usual as he gamely plied his way through one mediocre guitar solo after another. After some discussion about having Paul play the part instead, George Martin decided to employ the same wind-up piano technique as he had used previously on Misery. So basically what they do is they roll the tape at half speed and George plays the solo, and then they speed it up. But it's just, Emmerich is just... never says anything positive about George in that book at all.
It's been some years since I've read it. I must take it down again and give it another scan. But yeah, it is a bit of an odd
book. Don't bother.
I'll just use it to fix a wobbly table.
But you and I heard Paul play this.
Yes, and so the last time we saw Paul live to date was the end of 2018, and he opened with A Hard Day's Night.
Yes, but not with that chord.
When they came out and played that chord, I thought initially, oh, has Paul changed his tunings? Has he gone
down?
Yes,
I thought he maybe dropped. That was my initial thought, but I don't think he has.
No, he hasn't.
It was just not the right chord not the right sound. It didn't sound right.
And so, you know, and he's starting his gig with, you know, this song, which you could argue is a John song, and Paul is doing it. You know, was it as good an opener as Figure of Eight? I don't know. I think Figure of Eight.
I definitely think it was better than Figure of Eight.
Imagine if he'd come out in 2018 and opened a gig with Figure of Eight. There'd be one happy guy in the audience. This one. And then he'd do this one. That'd be great. Anyway, we're getting off track here a little bit. And it also appears on the Hollywood Bowl 8 Days a Week album as well. But, you know, if you're following the timeline here, there's still 10 days left of filming on the movie. But we now have a title and a song. And, you know, if you think about the movie, you know, because of the filming schedule, we don't see them sing A Hard Day's Night in the film. It's used in that opening scene where they're running down the street. So you know, you don't actually see them, open inverted commas, perform it, close inverted commas. So when filming ends on April the 24th, obviously we still don't have all the songs for the Hard Day's Night movie, but probably, or for the Hard Day's Night album. But, you know, it makes perfect sense at this point to just go and take a huge holiday.
End of part one. Intermission.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
End of intermission. Part two.
Looking back at 64 for talking about this today, I hadn't realized quite how much time they took off in May 64. And again, you know, they're out of the public eye making a film. You'd think, okay, guys, have a day off after the film and we'll get you back in the public eye. But essentially, the four of them are away from May 2nd to May 27th on different holidays. And they're holidaying in different kind of combinations.
Yes. So George and John and their respective partners, Cynthia and Patty Boyd, they head off together. And that I don't know why that strikes me as odd. Yeah. But that you wouldn't necessarily, I think, put George and John together. You think?
Not necessarily, no. And, you know, George brings Patty Boyd, who obviously he's just met on the set of A Hard Day's Night. So, you know, it's literally a few weeks, maybe 6 weeks since they've started going out. And it's like, yeah, let's all go to Tahiti. Isn't that where they end up?
Yes, they end up in Tahiti. So this is what we were saying at the beginning. These songs are written in Paris. They're written in New York. They're written in Tahiti. It's not Fortland Road. You know,
no.
They're
not nipping next door to Paul's dad in Tahiti. No.
What do you think of this,
yes,
Jim?
Yes. So they
go off on this holiday. So again, there is this sort of strange dichotomy of the fact that, as you say, they're just on this treadmill, and but then suddenly there is this long break, and it may just be that they sort of insisted, you know, after the filming, I think they regarded as a pretty tedious affair. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of waiting around. You know, they get into the studio, they're in their home environment, they can rattle off a song in 3 hours and they can get it from start to finish. Filming, there's just a lot of sitting around waiting, you know, reading lines, rehearsing. Maybe they just felt we need this break.
Yeah. And then Paul and Ringo kind of go off on their own jolly together, don't they?
Yes. So again, it seems an odd split there.
Yeah.
You know, but you would think it would be John and Paul and George and Ringo would go off. But you know, perhaps they just, you know, wanted to go to Tahiti.
Why not?
Well, you kind of think in the early 60s, if you were from working class Liverpool, you think, where's the most exotic place in the world that you could go to? Well, it's the South Sea Islands. It's going to be.
Well, it's the first time in their lives they you know, and it's only been a problem for a number of weeks at this point, where they're like, well, where can we go in the world where we won't be annoyed or disturbed? And it's up to Derek Taylor to arrange all of this holidaying. That's like one of his first, or is one of his earliest jobs for the Fab Four.
It is, and if you've got that book, or if you can find that book, it's very hard to find and very expensive to buy. 50 Years Adrift. He talks about it in that, and he talks about the, you know, organizing it and having to come up with sort of, you know, pseudonyms for them all. And then at one point they realize George doesn't have his passport. And yes, can we say, yes, Maureen's pseudonym.
We need to talk about the pseudonyms here.
We do need to talk about the pseudonyms.
Paul and Jane Asher on their holidays were Mr. Manning and Miss Ashcroft. But Ringo and Maureen Cox, what were their names?
Mr. Stone and Miss Cockcroft.
Miss Cockcroft, any relation, Stephen?
I think that's my way in. I think that's my, if I ever meet Ringo.
Ringo. Oh, yes. Your first wife's pseudonym is the same as my name.
It's the same as mine.
And he'll be like, get out of my house.
Yes.
peace and love.
Get out of my house.
You know, I kind of feel pity for Derek Taylor trying to organize such an intricate holiday in early 64 when, you know, we don't have all the mobile phones and communications that we have now, trying to get four of the most famous people in the world to a very secret and private place and managing their passports and their tickets and their names and all these other code.
The most interesting thing is that Ringo, for some reason, had George's passport. and then they kind of had, but he still got through customs with George's passport. I mean, he still got to where they corrected it for the trip home. But
it was a different world, wasn't it?
Different world.
It's like Paul getting to France to do a Fool on the Hill with no passport,
with no passport,
pointing at his face.
Yeah. My face is my passport.
Yeah. And the George and John holiday is, you know, they go to Honolulu and then they connect to Tahiti and then they go off to the north of the island and then they're on a boat and they're getting sick and vomiting and unwell. And
it's not what you would want from a Tahitian wake. You know, but there is some sort of little 16 mil or 8 mil film home movie footage. And there's a terrible picture of John and George wearing wigs, and they're obviously trying to have as normal a break as possible. You know, as you say, I think it probably is this idea of where can we go where we're not going to be mobbed, we're not going to be recognized.
Yes, because, you know, at this point, they're kind of, if you wrap in the UK experience, they've had a very intense year of attention. George says in the anthology that John spends some of the time writing A Spaniard in the Works, and, you know, they eventually, you know, even though they've got you know, wigs and all sorts of disguises on, they do have a couple of days out swimming and enjoying the warm weather and snorkeling and being treated to potato-based Tahitian food.
Yeah, but my favourite comment is George's take on the whole thing. It said, we discovered that all those wonderful native girls that you read so much about had no teeth because the Americans went down there with their chewing gum during the war with Japan. So I just thought that's a very specific
detail to notice.
Very specific. His big takeaway is that, you know, they have terrible... they have terrible teeth.
Terrible teeth. So yeah. So they have this month off on holiday. So in this busiest of year, where they're doing an insane amount of things, they have 3.5 weeks from May 2nd to May 27th, going off on different holidays together. But when they come back, there is work to be done because you know, there's still this notion that the B side of the album needs to be finished. And this is where there's perhaps a bit of a split, because we'll come back to this later, but you know, there is an American A Hard Day's Night album and there is a UK A Hard Day's Night album, and they've more or less done everything they need to do for the US A Hard Day's Night album, because that's essentially the movie songs. But there is one more song that they're going to record that will get onto that album, and that's when they go back into the studio on June the 1st, 1964. They've got another 2-3 hour sessions booked, and they work on a couple of different songs that day. Now, they do record the cover versions Matchbox and Slow Down, and they go off to the Long Tall Sally EP. But the next original song they work on is I'll Cry Instead. And there's a notion that I'll Cry Instead is going to be in the movie, that they're not totally finished with movie songs yet.
Yes, this is very specifically written for the sequence, I think, where they're running down the staircase on the fire escape. And you're so familiar with that, and for the song, the soundtrack, it's very difficult to imagine that I'll Cry Instead, either lyrically or just as a song, would fit that sequence. But that's specifically the sequence that they're still looking for something for that.
Yeah, it's so iconic, that moment where they break out onto the fire escape to Can't Buy Me Love. It's I don't know, is it a bit naive of John to say, oh, I know just the song to fit that moment. It's I'll Cry Instead, where he sings very deep autobiographical lyrics. Like, men weren't singing about crying much back then. Well, maybe some of the overwrought 50s songs, maybe.
It doesn't fit at all. But he's still, in 1980, he's still fixated on this. He said, you know, I wrote that for Hard Day's Night, but Dick Lester didn't even want it. He resurrected Can't Buy Me Love for that sequence and said. So even this idea of he resurrected Can't Buy Me Love, I mean, it clearly is something that annoyed him at the time and was still annoying him in 1980.
Yeah, I mean, you know, maybe some enterprising soul might want to graft I'll Cry Instead onto the Hard Day's Night sequence, and I might do that myself. We can all see whether it works, whether when he sings, don't want to cry when there's people there, I get shy when they start to stare, you know, whether that equates with them running around and jumping
up and
down.
I know what that's going to be like. It's not going to work, but give it a go. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, it's the other point is, you know, can it be shoehorned into the movie in some other way? And it doesn't really make it, as the long and the short of it, you know?
No.
When the movie is released in the early 80s, it does get used as a kind of montage piece that's tacked on to the start of the movie, which, when I bought Hard Day's Night on VHS, that's how the movie started for me, was with that montage of I'll Cry Instead before the main movie started.
I don't remember that, but, you know, I
you'll take my word for it.
I'll take your word for it.
That was the red box Hard Day's Night one. No. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, like a red and blue cover. Yeah. Was that? Yes. My memory doesn't go back that far. I can't. You know, it's so long ago.
But there's still a lot to be done. So, as we said, there's other tracks to be recorded for the UK album. So the next one that gets pulled up is "I'll Be Back," which ends up being the album closer. That's a great album closer.
That's a very good album closer. I mean, they have form with good album closers, and they're still on track with this. This is a great song.
Yeah.
Completely written by John, says yes. John. It was co-write, according to Paul. But the consensus seems to be that this Anytime at All and When I Get Home, these are the songs that he wrote, that John wrote when they were in Tahiti. So perhaps, you know, when he got back, Paul polished it up a bit, but there seems to be a bit of a disagreement between the two of them as to what the input was.
Yeah, and I'll Be Back as kind of a certain subtlety that you mightn't necessarily associate with, you know, some of John's stuff necessarily at the time, which is usually quite strident and rocking and forthright.
Yes, again, this idea that there's just an increasing maturity in the approach. And you know, he's a married man with a kid and a house coming, you know, planning, and so it's a lot of different influences are coming in, and there is this notion that, you know, the first autobiographical song is Help.
Yeah.
I think we've kind of established that this is actually in.
Well, it goes
in this
back
album
to "There's a Place," almost. You know that is the first autobiographical song. Yeah. It's based on. He says it's based on Del Shannon.
Yes, he says it was based on Runaway. I have to say, I don't hear that.
Yeah, it's not obvious to me.
You know, we touched again a little bit on Del Shannon on the From Me to You episode. I don't necessarily hear that, but he's saying he was certainly influenced by Del Shannon.
Yeah. And I'll Be Back is a song that never gets played live. It does have that great, I like that version that pops up on Anthology. Again, you can kind of hear how they are working at
forming songs through,
in the studio. And so I think it's the first take that appears on Anthology 1 to give you a bit of insight into what's going on. So I'll Be Back is the last thing they get done on June 1st, but then there's another very full day's work done on June 2nd. And when you put June 1st and 2nd together, it's a very, very busy, very useful, productive 2 days in the studio. June 2nd kicks off with Anytime at All, which is a song that I like a lot. That kind of gunshot start, it really makes itself known.
It's a great song. It's a kind of classic Lennon song of that era.
And another Tahiti song, we think.
Yes,
possibly.
Possibly. I think it seems to have been written during that period. It just appears in the studio, and they start working on it. Again, it's a John song. He's the sole author, and you can hear it being worked out in the studio. There's early versions of it. Kicking Around turns up on Anthology.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it's still another one of those songs that, you know, he's still thinking about back in 1980, you know, it's, you know, C to A minor with me shouting in the background, you know, and it's a song that takes seven takes to get down. And, but, you know, they've got other things to get done that day, because they jump from Anytime at All to what I think is a, you know, extraordinary song, which is Paul's Things We Said Today.
Right. Extraordinary.
you don't like Things We Said Today?
I like it, but I think it's funny. I always think Things We Said Today is more like a John song. It's kind of very flat. It's a very, there isn't a kind of dramatic contrast in the middle eight that you would usually expect from Paul. There isn't. It's a song that, a little bit too long, it doesn't seem to go anywhere. Sorry, well, I appreciate I'm digging a hole for myself here with lots of people.
No, you're not digging a hole. I mean, the thing about Things We Said Today is that it's, you know, we've talked throughout these two episodes about, you know, Paul as a writer trying to find a voice or trying to filter out what's good and bad.
Yeah.
And what's striking about Things We Said Today is exactly the stuff you pointed out, is that it's not necessarily trying to be liked as a song. It's not like I Saw Her Standing There, which is like, okay, we're going to do a Chuck Berry type thing and you're going to want to dance to it. So Things We Said Today has it introduces a certain subtlety into what they do. And, you know, you mightn't necessarily notice you know, how catchy the song is or what's going on, because it's just has this kind of roll to it that's really seductive, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yeah, I can see where you're going with that. One of the things that's interesting to me is that when we're talking about the Dylan influence, one of the things about Dylan songs that this is, Dylan doesn't do middle eights.
Yeah.
You know, he just... you know, coming out of that folk tradition, that it's just not an issue. It's just not a thing. And, you know, all the way through 63, 64, 5, 6, there's just no middle eight is appearing.
Is that why Dylan chose it for the Art of McCartney tribute album?
And that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
I mean, he chooses this song. And I think, is that the case? Is McCartney, we always think of sort of Lennon being influenced by Dylan, but I think this is probably an example of Paul being influenced by Dylan, in that kind of, as you say, it's a kind of rolling feel to it. It doesn't have, it's not a song of contrast. It's not the kind of hook laden song that, you know, they're not writing another I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is designed for a specific thing. And it did just occur to me. Yeah. Dylan does a cover of that. That's the one.
He decides to choose. Very, very interesting cover.
It is an interesting cover.
And this so is only what, maybe, about 5 or 6 years ago that album came out, so it's recent.
It's recent, and I kind of do, just as we're talking about it, I suddenly think, oh, maybe I like that song more than than I thought it, because suddenly, it's just kind of occurred to me that that's McCartney's Dylan song.
Yeah, and you know, it also gets used as the B-side for the Hard Day's Night single in the UK. But, you know, it's a song that John rates, you know, even by 1980, John is saying, that's a good song. You know, and it's a song that's born from this May vacation. So Paul and Ringo are off on the Virgin Islands on a yacht called Happy Days, apparently. And Paul, never one to, you know, he loves a good lockdown. He's in one of the cabins below deck one day on his acoustic guitar. And, you know, you could smell the oil and the boat was rocking a bit. I'm not the best sailor in the world, so I wrote a little bit of it downstairs and the rest of it on the back deck where you couldn't smell the engine. And he also says, I wrote it on acoustic. It was a slightly nostalgic thing already. A future nostalgia. We'll remember the things we said today. And if any pop fans are out there, Future Nostalgia, one of the best albums of 2020 from Dua Lipa. I didn't realize that Paul McCartney had named that album. Which is
he gets everywhere. He gets everywhere.
It's a long game again. Everything's connected, you know. They do things we said today. John on acoustic guitar, George on electric rhythm guitar, Paul on bass and vocals, and Ringo on drums. And you know, it is an understated song, and it does sort of raise the curtain on, you know, things we said today could have slipped onto Rubber Soul. You know, it's not, it is that kind of vibe.
It absolutely foreshadows that sound that's coming, that kind of folk rock sound.
And that is a fun thing to do as you work your way through the Beatles catalogue, is to try and pull the song from each album that lets you get an idea of what the next album is like. And that's what I think Things We Said Today offers is a future of what they're going to do, you know?
Yeah.
So that's recording on June the 2nd. We still have the album's not full yet. So the next song that gets recorded, the last one that's recorded for the LP, although whether they know it at the time or not, is When I Get Home. Because when A Hard Day's Night comes out, it's a 13-track, not a 14-track EP. And When I Get Home, maybe my least favorite song on A Hard Day's Night.
I think that's probably
the tank is getting empty. Has been running on fumes for months anyway, and they've managed to pull out good tracks along the way. But When I Get Home isn't the best.
No, I think this is probably everybody's least favorite, but no doubt we'll be told otherwise.
Probably are totally wrong, and it takes 11 takes to get done. It never really got a second life. Not only did it not get performed live, it didn't even get an airing on the BBC, where most songs usually would pop up at some point or another, but it just didn't make it. So the album's got 13 tracks. It seems that the Beatles might have been planning to record the next day, June the 3rd, because they have session time booked to finish the album and work it off. But as we've recounted in other episodes, what happens on June the 3rd is that Ringo falls ill at the end of this recording bout for A Hard Day's Night, and right on the precipice of a world tour. And so June 3rd is International Here's Jimmy Nicol Day, where Jimmy Nicol, the temporary Ringo Starr drummer who gets drafted in for the first few dates of the Summer 64 World Tour, gets introduced to the Beatles. And we know that they're introduced in a studio, and instead of rehearsing the set list meticulously down to the wire, they just sort of arse around.
They rattle off six songs and they go, yeah, that'll do. And then they send Jimmy Nicol on his way. And then the three of them each record a demo. And that's just insane that they're about to embark on a world tour. You know, we've gone over this before, but you would think you would want to rehearse more than six songs with the guy that's going to be in a couple of days' time on stage with you performing to, you know, tens of thousands of people across the world.
Yeah, but they're probably at that, you know, great is the enemy of good point. We just gotta keep the show on the road. And whether that June 3rd recording date would have been, hey, here's something for Ringo, or let's get Ringo to rock out on one of his covers, you know, that they just didn't do that. And you know, as you say, they do some demos. They do You Know What to Do, the George song. They do You're My World, which is a Paul song for Cilla Black. And they work on a demo of No Reply. And that No Reply and You Know What to Do demos eventually surface on Anthology 1. But yeah, the album has no 14th song. They also do a bit of overdubbing that day on Anytime at All and Things We Said Today before they head off on tour. But essentially, the album is complete at that point. And, you know, they've simultaneously put together the tracks for the Long Tall Sally EP, and they don't pull any of those for the Help or for the Hard Day's Night album, which is curious.
No. Even I Call Your Name, which is technically, although it's been given away already, but it's still an original track that they could have tacked onto the album if they wanted to.
Yeah. And there's a Ringo song there. So, you know, they could have pulled Matchbox on, but then you spoil that perfect Lennon McCartney,
perfect. No, you can't do that.
So is it a perfect album?
Well, you know, let's talk about the album itself, because, you know, the release date pattern is, you know, in the midst of all this, we talk about them disappearing to make the movie. But of course, in the middle of the movie being made in March, they released the Can't Buy Me Love single in the UK and the US with You Can't Do That on the B-side. And Can't Buy Me Love is just instantaneously a massive hit, number one in the US and the UK. And as we said, it's the first post British Invasion new release that they put out in the US. So that's a big hit. Then on June 19th, they put out the Long Tall Sally EP, 9 minutes of glory. And why that comes out, I'm not really sure. It seems, you know, excessive, but they put out Long Tall Sally, which is the only all original material EP that the Beatles ever put out. The rest of their EPs are all just kind of little album collections of album tracks.
Yeah.
So that's June 19th. And then on June 26th in the US, the Hard Day's Night album comes out in the US, the US version. And should we talk about the US Hard Day's Night album first? Because this is obviously the whole point of this exercise, was that United Artists wanted an album that they could put out because they thought this group might be able to make them a bit of money, which is understatement of the year. But it's a different experience, the US Hard Day's Night album.
It is. And you imagine the executives in United Artists, whoever proposed this initially way back in October 63, when the Beatles were not big, not had no traction in the US. By the time the film comes out and the soundtrack album comes out, whoever that person was must have got a good bonus that year, you know, because they were the biggest thing on the planet at that stage. But the album is different because it's padded out with, I think, four orchestral instrumental versions. So you get Ringo's theme, which is this boy done as an orchestral treatment, which is Ringo walking along the canal. I should have known better, appears in an orchestral version, and I Love Her, and Hard Day's Night as well. So it's a very different experience. And what you then get is Capital use the songs that sort of mops up the rest, and then they put out. So again, there's a huge kind of overlapping of product coming out in America because of this United Artists soundtrack.
Yeah, it's so fast. So the United Artists soundtrack version of A Hard Day's Night, which has 8 Beatle original songs, so the 7 movie songs plus I'll Cry Instead. And, you know, the speed at which that's done, because I'll Cry Instead doesn't get recorded. Like it doesn't even exist until the 1st of June. And this album comes out on the 26th of June. That is fast.
It is fast. And this is why you end up with all of these different, you know, you get
mixes
songs which have extra verses and different
mixes
and things that are fixed and not fixed, because as soon as things are done, they're having to fire them off to United Artists in America in mono and stereo. And so there's a lot of sort of little quirky aspects to these tracks.
Yeah, because obviously we're living in an era before ISDN digital lines and all the rest. So, you know, what's happening is masters are being taken by somebody in an aeroplane to the US and a physical tape drawn down by the first generation master is being, you know, taken to a pressing plant in the US. So there's going to be little discrepancies and mess ups. And, you know, the United Artists album has 8 songs on it, as we said. The other 5 songs that make up the UK album end up on the Capitol release, Something New, which comes out in July 64. So that's got, 8 UK songs plus a further 3 tracks not previously released at that point in the US. So they're both, there's a period of time where, you know, the soundtrack album is number one in the US for 14 weeks, and Something New is sitting behind it at number 2 for 9 of those 14 weeks. So, you know, it's the high tide of Beatles sales.
It's absolutely 1964 is the pinnacle of that. Yeah, absolutely.
So that album comes out in the US on the 26th of June. The movie, it comes out in the UK on July 6th. So the movie in the UK precedes the album. So people going to see the movie in the UK are hearing these songs for the first time, it seems.
Yeah. So apart from Can't Buy Me Love, and You Can't Do That, these are new songs.
Yeah. And so the movie comes out in the UK on July 6th, and then the single and album comes out a few days later on July 10th, where the album and the Hard Day's Night single with Things We Said Today comes out on the back. So although we often talk about the Beatles didn't pull singles from albums, they're cutting it fine there by having a simultaneous release day for the single and the album.
Yeah, there are exceptions.
There are a couple of exceptions. And then the Hard Day's Night single comes out a few days later in the States, but the States don't actually get the movie until August the 11th. So, you know, we've got about a good 6 weeks between the US album coming out, and it's obviously stuck at number one. So people are quite familiar by the time they get to see the Hard Day's Night movie in August.
It's interesting that, you know, in the States, you're going out to buy the soundtrack album with orchestral versions of tracks before yes. before you get a chance to see the movie. You would think it would be the other way around. But it's just this pressure to get product on the shelves, get the cash registers ringing.
So let's talk about the UK album then, the album that's kind of slipped into canon all these years later, because, you know, this is... You know, you go to buy a Hard Day's Night now, it has settled on this 13-track version. Is it one of their best albums of all time, or is it compromised, do you think, or what's your take on it?
It's not an album that I have gone back to listen to for a number of years. I mean, just to listen to all the way through. But I've been doing that over the last week or two. And yeah, I actually do think it stands up incredibly yeah. well. You know, we talked in the past, you know, about Help and that being a transitional album, about Beatles for Sale. And I think certainly if you compare it with the two albums before and the two albums that come after,
yes.
I do think it's kind of up there with Rubber Soul. And the interesting point is the point that you made, you know, what are the songs here that foreshadow what's coming? So you've got the introduction of that Rickenbacker guitar sound on the title track, kind of prefigures what's going to happen on Ticket to Ride and Rubber Soul. The Things We Said Today, that's the sort of folk rock style of that's coming on Rubber Soul. So I think of those first five albums, this is the strongest. This is the strongest album. So yeah, I would definitely, it has moved up the rankings.
It's an album I love, and I think when I started to get into the Beatles, like many teenagers, you tend to tilt towards the old albums,
yeah.
the later albums, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, your White Album, your Pepper, your Abbey Road, and all the rest. You know, something we said in season one when we looked at Please Please Me is that by accident or design, the Beatles turned out to be an albums act from day one.
Yes.
You know, whether they meant to or not, and that's to do with the fact of, you know, I think their original songwriting and the fact that they, you know, kept albums and singles separate in some instances. But you get to something like A Hard Day's Night, which, you know, is you know, stuff that's put together in early 64. And what still hasn't really happened yet is you haven't had a full introduction of the Rolling Stones or the Kinks or the Who into the scene. They are still very much, you know, finding their feet and not well known. 65 is the real year when they all kick down the door and start doing their thing. So, you know, in the pop world at the time, when, you know, the first rock and roll record isn't even 10 years old, that's an eternity.
Yeah.
And something like A Hard Day's Night comes out, and it's, you know, it's a fully formed album, and what's, you know, and it's kind of against the odds because it's written, as we've kind of pointed out across these two episodes, it's written and created by the pin of their collar. There is a handful of days in the studio where they're actually, you know, recording. It's not even a week of recording if you put it all together in a row. And yet somehow they turn out an album of music with all original songs. It doesn't even have, you could argue, the care and attention of, you know, the cover. The cover is possibly the most dated Beatles album cover out of all of them.
Yes, yes. And the other thing I noticed on that cover, do you see the sequence in which they are? You would think that would be John, Paul, George, and Ringo, but they've swapped. It's John, George, Paul, and Ringo.
Yeah, and the other thing I wonder about the cover is, you know, as we mentioned at the start, was, you know, what was EMI Parlophone's feeling about promoting a movie that they weren't necessarily going to make any money off? And, it says on the back of the Parlophone release in the sleeve notes, it says, you know, from the soundtrack of the United Artists film A Hard Day's Night for side one. And the spiel on the back of the record, which is written by Tony Barrow, is very clear about rolling out, how they are writing for the film, and this is all for the film. So, it doesn't say on the front cover of the album from the film A Hard Day's Night, but it does say it at the top of the back cover of the album, songs from the film A Hard Day's Night. So I guess EMI just realized there wasn't any point in being coy to just say, here's an incidental collection of Beatles songs.
Yeah. I think it holds up. It's much more than just a collection of songs, and it's much more than just a soundtrack. And I think it is head and shoulders above the two albums on either side.
Yeah.
And
I know
think
some when, people, some with the Beatles fans would probably wrestle you on that, but.
One of the things, maybe do another episode right now on with the Beatles. One of the things about With the Beatles is they're still kind of dipping into covers, or they're still dipping into show tunes. They're still trying to cater for the sort of family audience, the kids, the moms, the dads, the grannies and granddads. They're trying to cover all the bases. Here, I think they're kind of, this is the first mature Beatles album. They're kind of moving in. The next two albums are a bit of maybe a step back, but this is the start. And you could easily, maybe, if you include Ticket to Ride in between as a standalone single, you could easily move from Hard Day's Night, Ticket to Ride, Rubber Soul.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And kind of to finish the thought I had a minute ago is that, as I got older and you go back to the early Beatles albums, something like A Hard Day's Night, especially when the mono versions came out in 2009, I really couldn't stop listening to it. It's just, it works from start to finish. It's sequenced fantastically well, obviously opening with A Hard Day's Night and, that B-side opening with Any Time at All, finishing with I'll Be Back. It's very thoughtful. I still don't know. Do we know who designed the cover? Is that lost to the midst of time? I
don't know. I don't know. Actually, we'll look at that and see if we can put something up. But you're right. I mean, it opens with that chord, and as you say, Any Time at All is like a gunshot. That's it's a big wall of sound in a good way, not in a Phil Spector way.
Oh man, I want to go off and listen to it now. By the way, as we talk, I am waving a copy of the album in Stephen's face. And
I have a copy here. Join you.
But the vinyl version I have here is a version that came out about 2 or 3 years ago when they re-released them with D'Agostini magazines. And controversially, the mastering on this, they make a mess. I was going to use an expletive of the opening chord. They cut off the first about 0.25 of a second of the opening chord. So you go to put it on and listen to it. And like when I bought it, I was like, yeah, get it home, put it on. And it's missing the very first part of the opening clang. Very, very, very annoying. It doesn't make it any more, valuable, it seems, but it's obviously a unique mastering for that album series. It sounds fantastic otherwise.
I'm going to have to go and buy a copy of that just to complete just kind to of get odds the, and ends, the, just to get the slightly damaged opening chord.
They'll put it in the box set, to recreate the thing, just, pause your CD after a split second after the chord starts. Listen, all this talking about it makes me want to go back and listen to it again. What do you think, folks? We want to send you back to the records every time we talk about these things. A Hard Day's Night, is it their best album? Is it the best of that kind of first pre-Rubber Soul run of albums? Maybe like some of the other records we've mentioned before, it doesn't have that kind of global appeal because there was a different version in the US. Maybe that's the version you're used to. Maybe that's the version you miss. Let us know what you think in all the usual places, on Twitter at Beatles Pod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, and the All Singing Bells and Whistles, Nothing Is Real Pod website.com. We've got lots of playlists up there. I can see there'll be a playlist for this episode of Bits and Pieces that we'll have to put up. Lots of Foremost, that we can
lots
put up
of foremost
there.
Songs,
lots of Foremost songs. Get in touch and let's keep the Beatle conversation going. A Hard Day's Night, the album. But for Nothing Is Real, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.